League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
All right, Matt, so I figured I should probably start telling some jokes about library books because they're long overdue.
Yeah.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
Not too bad, man.
Good
deal.
Not
too bad. I'm on the tail end of my work week, so I get a few days off. You know what's funny? I told Amanda this earlier today. I said, I have not had a non-sick day off in 2025.
Really?
Yeah. And she goes, you got to do better.
Right, right.
I was like, yes, I got to do better.
Yep. You got to try a little harder, Matt.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this is when my work week actually starts harder and heavier is, yeah. Right after recording.
Yeah. Yeah. This is when Adams picks up.
Yep.
How exactly. Hardcore.
But, before we get into it and before we get into more work that I got to do, we will ask this again and keep asking it. We're seeing a little bit of a growth from it back, but go make sure on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on, that you have auto download set. That really helps us out. It helps us, it helps our sponsors and everything for auto download to happen when we release a new episode, because apparently the new iOS updates and some of the updates on Androids as well has disabled that feature from a lot of podcasts. So go make sure that you have us auto downloading like you used to. Thank you. And we appreciate it. Also, go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. You can sign up to become a patron. We've got three different levels that you can sign up for: 1, 5, and 10, and all levels get a bonus episode a week. Our $5 and $10, they get the ad free audio and video versions of the main episode, plus the audio and video versions of the bonus Patreon episode. And then our $10, they get all of that, plus they get the audio and video versions of our second show, Side Quest, which Matt and I love to do. We're having a lot of fun with it. I got some stuff coming up that I think is going to be fun for Matt. We like to play games on there. And so I've got a game coming up that should be really fun. We have tried interesting snacks. We've watched videos. Recently, I did another video episode showing Matt some messed up videos. But if you want to hear Matt and I in a different context than Graveyard Tales, not as, I'd say, edited on the speech, we're a little bit freer with our language.
Yeah.
And we talk how we would normally talk. It's like hanging out with me and Matt when we're just messing with each other. So go over there, sign up, patreon.com/graveyardtales, become a patron, and check it all out. Also, go check out our sponsors. Go down in our show notes, find the link, click the link, use our promo code, get you something cool. Sign up for anything, because Matt and I, if we take the ad, we appreciate the company or we love the product or both, and we think that y'all are going to love it as well. All right, Matt. So that's all I've got for the housekeeping and all the boring stuff. So why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
So tonight we're going to talk about a legend that is fairly modern in the realm of legends, mm-hmm. starting in about the 1970s. And this comes out of the UK. And initially there were reports of an unusual large cat that began circulating around the farming communities in the Exmoor National Park region.
Regent's Banks?
Yes. Now, the early accounts established a pattern that would persist for decades. Sightings of a dark-colored cat, or a cat-like creature, a lot larger than a domestic cat, mm-hmm. typically is observed around twilight or at night in the rugged mountain terrain. Now, if you're not familiar with the Exmoor National Park area, there really shouldn't be any big cats like this running around there.
Right.
So
right.
a lot of stories began to swirl around about what is this? Is this, why is this cat here? Are we really seeing it? Is it a phantom? Is mm-hmm. it a cryptid? So tonight we're going to figure out what really is the beast of Exmoor. And, you know, it's a really interesting thing, because like I said, this is a more modern story. This is yeah. not something that has endured for 100 years. You know, it's been something recent. And, you know, nowadays with everybody having these security cameras and, you know, video doorbells and trail cams, people are catching odd things at night, you know, waking up to see, what was that? You know, yeah. what just walked through my yard? And so I think the Beast of Exmoor definitely falls into that realm.
Yeah, yep. Now, as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. Obviously, Matt and I have not been to Britain. Not lately. Yeah, no, not since ever. Like last week. You know, to look for this creature ourselves. So we have to go off people who live there, people who have studied it and all that. So go down to the bottom of our show notes, check our sources. You can continue the research or you can just double check what we said, because everything we talk about is sourced and referenced down in the show notes. Now, as Matt was saying, the Beast of Exmoor is said to be one of Britain's most famous cryptids. Its stories of its exploits, its nights out on the town, get repeated constantly. And so due to that, the phenomena has been extensively documented. People are talking about it, writing stuff about it, sharing stuff about it all the time. I'm sure you can find, if you're on like the locals group for this area in Britain, I'm sure there are, like Matt was talking before the mics got hot, about a bear in their uh-huh. area.
Yeah.
So he's seeing it all over Facebook. It's pretty much the same with the Beast of Exmoor. They're posting stuff about it, talking about it all the time. So what is the beast? Well, the beast is a large cat-like creature, and it roams the moorlands of Devon and Somerset, which is on the southwest side of England. So in order to get a good idea of whether or not this creature could be real, or is it just a legend? Is it, you know, mythical creature, whatever? Let's look at the habitat. So the Beast of Exmoor lives primarily in the Exmoor National Park, which Matt mentioned. And this park spans about 267 miles. Sorry, England, I am not doing kilometers. I refuse. when looking this up, because it's in the UK and stuff, all of the stuff was in kilometers. And I'm like, I understand kilometers, but I need to put it in miles so I get a better idea. So I went with miles, 267 square miles. Now it's described as a quote, upland moorland plateau with deeply incised river valleys and coastal cliffs. So Exmoor was designated as a national park in 1954. So a fairly new national park as far as national parks are concerned. Now, within this park, there's wide, expansive moorlands. There's ancient woodlands, mainly down toward the river valley. There's a large coastline along the Bristol Channel, which has a bunch of high sea cliffs. And among this land, there's also remote farmlands, small villages, and some ancient sites like prehistoric standing stones and burial mounds, which I'll talk about here in a second. But when people think of the park, they kind of describe it as extensive vegetation that includes heather moorland, coarse grasses, and blanket mires. So this vegetation supports a diverse range of animal species in the park. And due to the variety of habitats within the park, you know, the moorlands, the woodland, the rivers, the coastlines, there's a bunch of different animals that live in there. So let's look at first the mammals that live in Exmoor National Park. And I do this as with all areas that house a quote unquote cryptid, because we need to look at what the park can sustain and what kind of prey this cryptid might have, and could it live there? It were real and it were there, what could it live off of? So in this park, there are red deer, which is Britain's largest surviving land mammal, and they're seen commonly across the moorlands and the woodlands in the park. There's also the Exmoor pony, which is a native hardy pony breed, that was hard to say, with a long history on the moor, which maybe everybody's this way. Maybe it's just because I'm a Texas boy, but there is something to me that is so majestic about wild horses. Like
wild horses.
Yeah. See,
yeah.
You can see a herd of buffalo or, you know, any type of mass group of wild animals, and it's cool. But when you see a herd of wild horses running and just them doing their thing out there in the wild, I don't know why, but that's one of the most majestic looking things to me. Seeing a herd of wild horses run, no saddles in sight, and it's just cool to me. So The Exmoor pony caught my attention when doing this research. There's badgers, which are widespread throughout the whole area. There's bats. They're home to 16 of the 17 British breeding bat species. There's otters, which are present along the rivers and streams throughout the entire park. And there's hedgehogs and dormice in the woodland areas. And some of the birds that are there are skylarks, cuckoos, buzzards, kestrel, woodpeckers, owls, peregrine falcons, and a ton more. So, like we were saying, there's a ton of animals that live within this area. But you'll notice something missing in the mammals. There's no large cat species.
Right. Yeah.
There's really no large predators, period, in this area. You know, the UK has wolves in certain areas, but not really in this park.
Yeah.
So there's no large predators in this park.
Also not cats.
You know, right.
Wolves are not cats.
Right. True. And they don't pretend to be.
Well, sometimes. I've heard stories.
Halloween, you see a wolf dressed up as a lynx or something.
Yeah, you know, they decided that the sheep thing was played out. You know, start dressing like other
sheep. True. It makes sense. I mean, you always hear about wolf and sheep's clothing. You never hear about a wolf and lynx clothing. So
you remember that? You remember that Bugs Bunny where I was like Bugs and Granny, and they were, and it was like the red
Red Riding Hood.
Red Riding Hood. I wanted to say Red Robin Hood. I was like, that's not right. But he goes, you look, Granny, you look like a wolf in cheap clothing.
Yep.
I don't know why that always tickled me. This is hilarious.
A wolf in cheap clothing. So what has the Exmoor National Park been used for throughout the history of the area? So let's go back before it became a park. So the archaeological evidence shows that people have lived on Exmoor since the Mesolithic era. So that's about 8,000 years ago. They left behind stone tools, you know, burial mounds, standing stones, and the area is dotted with Bronze Age barrows and Iron Age hill forts. So this is evidence of very early settlement and ritual landscapes. Now, during the Middle Ages, Exmoor actually became a royal hunting forest. So it was officially designated for the crown's exclusive use. Now, the Royal Forest of Exmoor was administered by a warden who was a powerful position that controlled grazing rights and enforced strict forest laws, sometimes with harsh punishments. The forest was surveyed in 1815 to 1818, covering nearly 19,000 acres. So, you know, I know they did this all the time in England, UK, stuff like that, but having a royal hunting forest.
Yeah.
You know, that was one of the big things that the Robin Hood legends and stuff went off of.
Yeah.
Is hunting in the king's forest. It's like, man, it's everybody's forest. Let me hunt a deer in this dang forest too.
Why you got to own the whole forest, man?
Right. You have a castle. Do you really need an entire forest that only you can hunt? Yeah. Are you afraid I'm a better hunter than you, Mr. King?
Always.
Yep, that's what it is. He's just afraid I'm going to outshoot him and get a bigger deer.
Japan is a country known for its beauty, traditions, and some of the most chilling legends you've ever heard. I'm Kevin O'Shea, the host of Supernatural Japan, a podcast that dives deep into the country's darkest corners. Each episode brings you spine-tingling ghost stories, forgotten true crime cases, and eerie folklore, all wrapped in rich cultural and historical context. We explore haunted temples in the heart of Tokyo, mysterious disappearances in the shadow of Mount Fuji, and legends of yokai, spirits, and vengeful ghosts that still haunt Japan's forests, back streets, and abandoned places. Whether you're obsessed with true crime, fascinated by the supernatural, or simply curious about the eerie side of Japanese culture, Supernatural Japan will leave you looking over your shoulder. New episodes every week. Search for Supernatural Japan on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And remember, some stories were never meant to be forgotten.
So sheep farming for the wool trade ended up dominating Exmoor's medieval economy. So with wool spun on isolated farms and finished in towns like Dunster. So from the 17th century, the land was gradually enclosed, with larger estates forming and regular shaped fields replacing the open commons. So disputes over grazing rights were common as outsiders paid to graze livestock on the moor. So you can see even as far back as medieval times, there's wool being produced out of this area. And still, you've got farmland on the area where they're raising sheep. So it took over and that became one of the predominant things out of this land. Now, in 1818, the crown sold a quarter of the royal forest to John Knight, who began converting it into farmland. He built many of the large farms and roads that you still see today. So the area's only house at the time was Simon's Bath House, which became the center of Knight's Estate. How it got the name Simon's Bathhouse, I don't... It sounds like a bathhouse.
Yeah.
For a dude named Simon.
Well, yeah. That's what I would guess.
So, was it that? Did this guy have... Maybe. Started running a bathhouse out of his land, and they're like, we'll call it Simon's Bathhouse.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me.
Right? See? And that's ignorant about UK and England history is what that is.
Yeah.
Now, mining all...
Sorry, guys. We're...
Yeah. Yeah. We make jokes because we're stupid, and that's how we make sense of things. Mm-hmm. Now, mining also played a role in Exmoor's history. There were copper and iron mines that were active in the 19th century. Now, the two world wars saw further agricultural intensification because the government encouraged the plowing of the moorlands so that they could boost food production. So during the world wars, they needed more food, and they said, all right, go ahead. Y'all go plow and plant the moorlands so we can feed everybody. Now, Exmoor was designated a national park on October 19th, 1954. It became the 8th national park in the UK. So the park was established to protect its landscapes, wildlife, and the cultural heritage while providing opportunities for public enjoyment. Today, there's about 3/4 of the park that's privately owned, with the National Trust and the National Park Authority among the largest landowners. So I mentioned the ancient sites. So let's look at a few of these ancient sites just for shiggles, just because it's interesting to me. So the Tar Steps, this is supposedly from the Bronze Age. This is a clapper bridge or ancient stone footbridge, and it's located across the River Barle. And I think that's how you pronounce that. That's how I'm going with it.
Yeah.
It's believed that it dates back to 1000 BCE. It's constructed of massive stone slabs, and it's the longest clapper bridge in Britain. There's folklore about this bridge, though, that says it was built by the devil, and he dared anyone to cross it.
I got a question.
All right.
I'm going to look it up. What is a clapper bridge?
Well, it's one that every time you pass, you have to go as you walk across it.
It says that it is a type of bridge often found in rural areas, particularly in Britain, that consists of a deck made of flat stone slabs resting on stone supports or piers. It says these bridges are considered an ancient form of bridging, often built near fords, and are known for their simple design and rustic appearance. Okay, I get it.
So, like I said, you got to clap when you go across it.
Oh, okay, now I'm looking at a picture. Now it makes perfect sense. Wow, that is, the fact that this thing is still around is amazing. Okay? I mean, it's like a rock sandbar.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's one of the ancient sites that they're protecting, which is probably good that they protect it.
That's probably why it's still standing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the next one is the Dunkery Beacon Cairns. So, man, I know that people in the UK will say the same thing about stuff in the US, but they got funny names for things.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is apparently a Bronze Age burial cairns. And Dunkery Beacon, it's the highest point on Exmoor. There's multiple cairns near the summit, which likely served as ceremonial or funerary purposes. And it offers really great views of the moor. So it was apparently a very powerful location for prehistoric monuments to be built. So... I think it's interesting that this Dunkery Beacon is the highest point in Exmoor.
Mm-hmm.
They also have the Lanacombe Standing Stones. And since we just did an episode on the most famous standing stones I thought we should include this. But this is just a small set of standing stones. It's in southern Exmoor near Simon's Bath. And there's multiple stone rows and circles that are often aligned with each other. And it was possibly used for rituals or as territorial markers. And it's unique to Exmoor. And it's really not that well understood by archaeologists and historians as to what it was for. The last one I got is the Codson Moor Barrows. And this is Bronze Age burial mounds or barrows. And it's located near Weedon Cross. And this is a group of round barrows, some visible as raised grassy mounds. And this was likely used for elite burials. So during the Bronze Age, they would bury the higher ups in society in these barrows.
Yeah. And you know, one thing that I found really, really interesting is how beautiful this park is. It is not like the national parks here. I mean, the geography is different, but you know, when I think national park, because you know, I'm an American, I think of what is around me. And when you look at the photos from Exmoor National Park, I mean, it is breathtaking. I mean, it looks like something out of, I expect to see somebody put a little Gandalf standing right in there with some dwarves following him. I mean, it's what it looks like. I mean, it's just amazing. What I would not expect to see in any of these photos is a like cougar or a panther.
Right.
And it would look remarkably out of place. And hey, guess what? The people around Exmoor National Park said the same thing. They're like, hey, a great big cat roaming around this area looks really out of place.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
right.
It's like we don't really see that ever. You know, it's not like, oh, well, you see that sometimes. No, we see it never.
But yeah, right.
Back in the 1970s, they absolutely started seeing it. And one thing, and I'll lead into this so that as you listen, you can kind of keep this in the back of your mind with, you know, the descriptions and the eyewitness stories of what was nicknamed the Beast of Exmoor. It's the timing of the sightings in the 1970s coincide with a broader cultural issue. And there were legislative changes in Britain that focused on the ownership of exotic pets.
Mm-hmm.
And this legislation, it addressed a situation that began to grow from the 1960s and early 1970s of wealthy people looking to keep these large exotic cats as a status symbol. Okay.
Right.
And you've seen that now. I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm super cool. I'm a rich rock star and I've got some 20-foot python that, you know, mm-hmm. I carry around. Or, you know, I've got a white tiger that lives in my apartment with me. Or yeah. I've got a giraffe in my backyard. You know,
well, you see it in like Abu Dhabi or whatever.
Right.
The people over there, I saw a video of this prince or whatever who had friends over swimming in his pool. And he let his tiger out to jump in the pool with these people. Didn't tell them. So all of a sudden, they just got a giant tiger jumping in the pool with them. Mm-hmm. And they freaked out and ran and stuff. So, you know, you see a lot of large cats being kept. But I can't really say anything because there are more large cats in captivity in Texas than there are in the wild.
Yeah. Thank you, Tiger King.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, but Adam's right. It's not a joke. I mean, you know, these people get these pets and either they realize we cannot keep this animal. It is dangerous. We can't feed it. We can't enclose it. It's cruel to do mm-hmm. such a thing to this animal put them in a habitat that is not anywhere near what they would natively be in. And they graciously let them go, which is even worse. But, you know, there's a lot of these large cats in the U.S. that are in rescue habitats, or I guess rescue centers, where that's what they specialize in, is getting these big cats away from people that are either selling them or, you know, they keep them and they just can't handle it. And it's bad for the animal. It's bad for the owners. You know, that's what was going on in Britain in the 1960s and early 70s. And so they started to pass laws regarding the ownership of these animals because they saw it could be a potential problem. And then we start hearing the stories of the Beast of Exmoor. So just keep that in mind as we listen to some of these eyewitness stories.
Yeah.
Now, 1983 was kind of the pivotal year for the legend of the Beast of Exmoor. And it turned it from this isolated rural report into a nationally recognized phenomenon. Eric Lay, who is a farmer in the South Moulton area, experienced devastating livestock losses when it was estimated he lost 80 to 100 sheep that were killed over a period of 3 months.
That's crazy.
They all displayed identical patterns of predation characterized by precise throat wounds and a bloodless carcass. Now, that, you know, like, I didn't know England had chupacabra.
Right.
You know? But it wasn't a chupacabra. It was something else. So Mike Williams, who was another local farmer, provided detailed descriptions of the carnage, saying, quote, "The face and neck were stripped off, and the attacks were so quick, the animal didn't struggle, and so quiet nearby sheep were undisturbed." So that's
interesting.
It's very interesting. But these incidents prompted unprecedented community response and media attention, officially establishing the Beast of Exmoor designation that we still hear today. The consistency and severity of the livestock predation patterns convinced many local residents that they were dealing with an apex predator capable of sophisticated hunting behavior far beyond those of typical British wildlife. So, you know, typical British wildlife, you know, they just kind of stagger in, be like, "Hey, we're looking for some food." No.
"Pardon me, sir. Might I kill you for some dinner?" It's not as sophisticated as the British predators are.
That's exactly right. But just like Adam said at the beginning, they didn't have a big cat predator in that area. So they weren't used to seeing this. They could tell, "Oh, this is a coyote. Oh, this is a fox." You know, but they weren't looking at that. They knew what that already looked like, and this was different.
Right.
So the 1983 events also attracted the attention of researchers and investigators, including Nigel Brierley. Let's go with Brierley. I like that better.
That sounds better.
He would document that these all of these experiences in his book called They Stalk by Night. Now, witness testimonies, which span decades, have produced remarkably consistent physical descriptions of the Beast of Exmoor, suggesting either a genuine biological entity or a deeply embedded cultural archetype. So, you know, is this an actual creature that's out here, or is something happening and the villagers, the townspeople in the area, the local farmers, they have, much like the chupacabra stories, developed a creature in their mind that they routinely see? I mean, how many times when we talked about the chupacabra do we hear stories that it's like, that sounds just like something else? You know?
Yeah.
Oh, you saw this? You probably saw this. But because of the consistency of the attacks, you know, the locals have thought, no, it's not that. We know what that is. It's something else. And that's kind of what we're looking at here. Is it real or is it something totally different and it's being misunderstood? So let's talk about what it looks like. The creature is typically described as measuring between 4 to 6 feet in length. So not ridiculously huge, with a long, thick tail and a low slung posture, which is characteristic of a feline. The most commonly reported coloration is black or very dark gray, though a few accounts describe brownish hues. So, you know, pantherish appearance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Witnesses frequently emphasize the character's substantial size, noting that it appears far too big to be a domestic cat. 4 to 6 feet in length.
Yeah.
That's far too big to be a domestic cat.
It's far too big.
I've seen some big domestic cats.
Yeah, Maine Coons.
Yeah, I've never seen one 4 to 6 feet.
Right.
And now this leads me into something else. This is our tangent for the night. So I had an experience about 20 years ago or so. And I made a comment about this experience to Amanda and my children. And to this day, even this last week, I am routinely made fun of for bringing up this experience. I am driving in Goodlettsville, Tennessee. So if you mm-hmm. want to look it up, that's where I was. I'm coming down Highway 31. And there's an area there where there is an old like railway bridge. Okay. And you go under the bridge. As I'm going under the bridge, I see right up on the side of the road what appears to be a groundhog that I estimated to be about 4 feet tall. Okay.
That's a large.
So I made the comment that groundhogs can grow to about 4 feet tall. And so I have been ridiculed about this comment for the last 20 years. But I tell them, look, what I saw looked like a groundhog.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was fat, sat up. I said it was on all fours. It sat up and sitting up on its haunches. It was about 4 feet tall. So I don't know if what I saw was a groundhog. I have seen other groundhogs. I know that they don't typically grow to 4 feet tall.
Right.
But like I said, I saw what I saw. Okay.
So
I've never seen a 4 foot domestic cat.
Right. Well, it's what you didn't know is shortly after that, the Goodlettsville groundhog legend started. And now
that's right.
They have a giant groundhog legend in Goodlettsville.
If I got any listeners over in that area, tell me if you've ever seen a giant groundhog creeping around.
Right.
You know,
the beast of Goodlettsville.
He'd be 20 years older now, so you might need I may need to get a police sketch of what it looks like
now. Right.
Age it a little bit.
Yeah.
What is the lifespan of a 4 foot tall groundhog?
Yeah, right.
But they do say, even though it looks too big to be a domestic cat, they do compare its dimensions to those of a puma or leopard or another big cat in that species. One particularly detailed account from July of 2012, like not that long ago, it described the creature as having pointed black-tipped ears in the strike position and noted that the dimensions of this creature were markedly similar to cougars and bobcats familiar to the witness from Western Canada. This comparative framework provided by the witness with relevant experience adds credibility to the reports and suggests that other observers are making informed assessments rather than simple misidentifications. So again, we run into that. How do you know it's a puma or a cougar if we don't have puma and cougars around here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've never seen one, how can you assume that that's what it is or that's what it looks like? So they didn't bring him in, but while he was there, I mean, he had been in Western Canada, which you're going to see mountain lions. You're going to see bobcats.
We see
bobcats around here all the time.
Yeah.
So you know what they look like, you know what they're shaped like, and you know about how big they get, you know? So if you've never seen a bobcat, they can get pretty big.
Yeah.
You know, they're not as big as say like a cougar. But you know, they're kind of, they're a little bit smaller, but they're mean as hell. And
you gotta
be mindful of them because they're big enough to mess you up. If you got
to make some crazy noises.
Yeah.
If you've ever heard, bobcats out in the wild making crazy noises, mm-hmm. you haven't lived. Because they sound like women screaming.
They sound like women screaming, yeah.
They can make baby sounds. Just go Google two bobcats yelling at each other.
Yeah.
And watch that video.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, crazy noises.
And it's because of all the noises that bobcats can make and because of the areas that they inhabit, those noises are often attributed to Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of debunkers will say, this is not a Sasquatch that you are hearing. These are bobcats because they make all kinds of crazy noises that you think of that weird high-pitched, you know, hissy roar. And they can make that. But they make so many other things that if you're not familiar with it and you hear it at a distance, you may automatically assume it's a Bigfoot out there hollering mm-hmm. and hooping. But maybe it is, maybe it's a bobcat. So, but moving on, there have been some recent sightings that follow the established patterns, but they have improved because of the technology. Like you said, you know, video doorbells and trail cams and whatnot. So in January of 2022, just a few years ago, wildlife photographer Sam Astin captured what he believed to be photographic evidence of the beast during a dog walk on Exmoor. Astin's account described a big cat with characteristic features, including a long tail and movement patterns that, quote, didn't run like a dog, but rather displayed distinctly feline locomotion. And his observation of the creature that moved like a cat was running toward a wooded area. And that fits in with previous descriptions that we've had for the, you know, since the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But Astin's experience illustrates the ongoing nature of the phenomenon and the psychological impact on witnesses. Despite his professional background in wildlife photography, he expressed uncertainty about his observation. And he wrote, quote, I think it was a big cat, but maybe wrong given the unlikelihood. The worst thing is, I'll never know. And that kind of reflects this broader challenge that's faced by witnesses who encounter phenomena that they challenge conventional understanding of what British wildlife ecology is. So to sum that up, you've got people that have seen this thing and have provided pretty decent descriptions. Now you have advanced technology, photographic evidence, but it's kind of like seeing a turd in a punch bowl. You know, it's like that doesn't belong there. It stands mm-hmm. out. You know, why is it here? Surely to God, somebody didn't put a turd in this punch bowl. That can't be. It's something else. It must be a baby Ruth, you know, something like that. It boggles the mind because what you're seeing is so out of context.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I think that really plays into this legend because just like Adam said at the top of the show, right? just about 15 minutes north of me is a more rural area. And sure enough, we've got a black bear running around. And mm-hmm. I mean, and this is not stories. This is like I told Adam before we started recording, I could go to my phone right now and I guarantee you somebody has posted a video of this bear in the last 30 minutes. I mean, hundreds of people have seen this. We have videos every day of this thing for the last 3 days. It's walking down the street. It's running through the woods. It's carrying picnic baskets. I mean, it is a bear, and there is no doubt that it is a bear. And it does not belong here. But with the way that black bear especially have migrated towards Middle Tennessee, from East Tennessee and the mountains, and from southern Kentucky,
the fires in Gatlinburg and stuff.
It's not ridiculously unheard of for there to be a bear running around,
right?
But we're talking about an area that is on an island,
mm-hmm.
and they're looking at this going, this thing didn't migrate here, why would it be here? I mean, there's not a really logical explanation for it. So people began to really dig in and investigate what it was, if it was anything, and, could it potentially be an actual, big cat predator that has somehow made its way into Exmoor? So in 1983, the livestock predation crisis prompted official intervention, and the British Royal Marines were deployed to Exmoor in an unprecedented search operation. They called the Marines, for crying out loud.
That's wild.
This military involvement represented the most significant institutional response to the beast phenomenon and demonstrated the severity with which authorities treated these reports. Okay? So it was more than just a legend. There were actual farmers that were losing actual livestock. So this was a problem, and mm-hmm. it needed to be addressed. So they needed an answer. And
it wasn't just some old dude sitting there making up tales about something he saw slinking through. There was actual property damage and death with this beast.
Well,
so they took it a little more seriously.
It's like the old saying, if you want to get the government's attention, hit them in their wallet. Mm-hmm. And, this was causing a financial hardship, not just for these farmers, but eventually for the local economy. So they needed to do something. Now, local community responses included both organized hunting expeditions and more informal investigative efforts. That is the buddies that knocked back a few at the pub and said, let's go find this beast of Exmoor.
Yeah, right. Right.
And they go out rolling through the woods.
Mount up, boys. We're hunting the beast.
Yeah. So Nigel Brierley documented some of these early attempts, noting that one chap had a butterfly net and another chap who was good at catching stray dogs came up from Plymouth and trailed a large piece of meat around the moor in an effort to attract the creature.
Man.
These are astronomically bad ideas, okay?
Yeah. Yep.
Because
so you've got a potential right. You've got a potential predator out there, like the lights of which that area of Britain has never seen.
Right.
Killing hundreds of sheep.
Yeah.
And you're dragging around a piece of meat. You might as well wear the Lady Gaga meat suit.
Yeah, exactly.
And then a dude with a butterfly net? Seriously?
A butterfly net, yeah. What?
What? You're just going to piss it off is all you're going to do.
Oh, man. I'm really hoping he was drunk. I mean, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these methods seem a little unsophisticated in retrospect, but they demonstrate the genuine concern of the local residents to address what they perceived as a significant threat to their livelihood and safety.
I'd be more concerned about the meat guy than
right, yeah.
the the Beast of Exmoor.
Yeah. Now, remember what I told you to kind of keep in the back of your mind, that there was an issue with people owning large cats as pets. And the legislative context surrounding exotic pet ownership, you can't deny that this legend is firmly pressed against the background of what was going on in the legislature at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The Dangerous Wild Animals Act of 1976 fundamentally altered the legal landscape for keeping large exotic cats in Britain, requiring licenses and creating significant regulatory barriers for private ownership. The legislation specifically targeted the growing trend of keeping, quote, dangerous wild animals as pets. Okay, which, like I said, had become kind of the thing to do in the 60s and 70s. So the timing of that legislation and the timing of the Beast of Exmoor sightings led researchers to theorize that some exotic cat owners may have released their animals into the wild rather than comply with the new licensing requirements. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So this was known as the release hypothesis, and it suggested that the beast phenomenon could represent the descendants of originally captive large cats that established wild populations in a suitable habitat. And given that pumas and leopards typically live 12 to 15 years in the wild, successful breeding would be necessary to sustain populations beyond the initial release generation. So if what it's saying is if we're seeing evidence of these things into 2012 and as recent as 2022, we know that it's not the original ones that would have been released back in the 70s.
Right. Okay.
They would have died out, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s at the latest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there must have been enough of them that they were able to create a breeding population. So Exmoor National Park, this is important to note, it covers 267 square miles. And as Adam described it, it's open moorland, deep valleys, ancient woodlands, and rugged coastline. So the landscape complexity provides numerous potential refuge areas for large predators, with extensive cover for denning and abundant prey species, including sheep, deer, and smaller mammals. So the region's relatively low human population density and limited development create conditions that could theoretically support secretive large carnivores. So it all seems to come together. It's like we've got the perfect storm for something like this to happen. Not a lot of people, a lot of places to cover, adequate food supply. All you need now is a few of these cats. And
right. I mean, the deer that they've got out in that area, they got enough deer to support a large breeding population of those cats.
Yeah. And even more so, the predation patterns that we talked about with the sheep, okay, that suggests a sophisticated hunting behavior, which is consistent with large felines.
Mm-hmm.
The precision of the throat wounds, the drainage of blood from carcasses, and the ability to kill without disturbing nearby animals all align with known puma and leopard hunting techniques. So these behavioral signatures provide some of the most compelling evidence for the presence of genuine large cats, not cryptids. And they would be difficult to replicate through alternative explanations, such as a population of domestic animals that became predators or human interference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one significant development occurred in 2006 when a skull was discovered by a Devon farmer, and it was initially identified by the British Big Cat Society as belonging to a puma.
Hmm.
However, This identification was subsequently disputed by the Department for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs, which maintained its position that no evidence supported the presence of wild big cat populations in England. So this disagreement highlights the ongoing tension between the amateur researchers and the official institutions regarding evidence standards and interpretations. So, you know, the government says, no way, but these people that are out here living that life, they're going, come out here.
This way.
Come out my way for a while.
Well, and that's my problem with a lot of these, quote, institutions that we see it here in the U.S. all the time with stuff is they brought a puma skull, had it identified, and then the answer was, no, it can't be puma because we don't have those here. Well, I have evidence that we do have them here, or that somebody threw a puma skull out in my yard.
Right, yeah.
That's the only two options.
Yeah.
You can't say this is not a puma skull because we haven't had those here.
Yep.
You can't say that unless you can then say it's not a puma skull. We don't have those here. It is a blank.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't do that.
Right.
They just said no because there's no evidence of them living here. Well, there is. And one of the biggest pieces of evidence is this puma skull that I just brought in.
That's right. You imagine standing there with this damn skull in your hand and then going, nope. No,
you didn't bring in a puma skull.
There's no pumas.
Yeah, there's no. What is this then as I make it talk at him? What is this?
Yeah.
What am I?
It's the newest Muppet, puma skull.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, here you go.
That's not a puma skull. That is Nancy's really large Maine Coon cat that got out. And that's what it is. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, not. Now, coverage of the Beast of Exmoor phenomenon in books and documentaries and news media has significantly shaped the public understanding and expectations surrounding the creature. Of course, you know, the official media is going to buck up against these, but just like we see in this country when we talk about, you know, things like Bigfoot and, you know, Champ and all these other, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Jersey Devil, you know, the official stance is going to be, it's something else. You know, it's not that, but all of these, these filmmakers, these documentarians, these amateur researchers are going to go, it's got to be something. You know, we're looking at it. We're looking at the evidence. Don't tell me that it's not this without telling me what you think it could be.
That's 100% my thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking to the people that have experienced it, that live in that area, that see the evidence all the time. And then you, Mr. Hoity-toity over in his academic world, is saying no, just because what? You've never heard of it before? Well, it's probably because you haven't been listening, because these people have been talking about it for decades, and you just are unwilling to listen. And like you said, don't tell me, no, it's not a puma, without telling me then, okay, well, what is it then?
Exactly. And of course, all of that takes the legend and the stories and the eyewitness accounts and builds up these cryptozoological tropes. You know, okay, the government tells us it's not a puma, it's not a leopard. We've seen what looks like a puma or a leopard, but yet we can't seem to find them out in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
So what must it be? It must be something we haven't discovered yet, or some type of mythological beast, or an interdimensional big cat, something like that. So the mystery and the elusiveness and the lack of any conventional explanation, that's where people are going to turn. And so that's that's how the legend turned into what it is today. Could it possibly be some mysterious, you know, cryptid large cat? Mm-hmm. And recent developments in social media and digital photography have created even more dynamics in Beast of Exmoor documentation, just like Sam Astin's photograph from 2022. You know, it generated immediate public debate and analysis, demonstrating how contemporary communication technologies can amplify these cryptozoological claims. You know, he posts a picture, but then in the same breath says, "I'm not so sure that that's what I saw, because that doesn't belong here."
Yeah.
So you've got an expert in this field going, "I'm not so sure." And right. And that right there just feeds that cryptid narrative. Yep. And ultimately,
puts fuel on the fire.
It's what led to it becoming a research topic for Adam and I.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, modern research into the beast phenomenon benefits from, like I said, the improved technology and trail cameras, DNA analysis, and sophisticated tracking equipment. But even with these technological advances, we still don't have definitive evidence suggesting that either the creature does not exist at all, or it possesses remarkable abilities to avoid detection. What does that sound like?
Yeah.
Now, the British Big Cat Society and other research organizations continue to coordinate systematic monitoring efforts across suspected habitat areas. And recent podcast productions such as Big Cat Conversations have created new platforms for sharing firsthand accounts and analytical discussions about big cat phenomena. And these media formats allowed for more detailed exploration of witness experiences and researcher methodologies than the traditional news coverage, potentially contributing to improved understanding of the phenomena's complexity. So it's a fascinating story, but it just shows how all the evidence in the world to suggest one thing without a definitive answer leads to the creation of stories like this. Mm-hmm. What fascinates me about this one in particular is if you told me that this story began in 1770 and went through 1825 and the government said, no big cats, nothing like this. And all these townspeople were going, "But look at this skull, look at these dead sheep, look at these deer, you know, look at these eyewitness reports. No, it just can't be. We just don't have them here." I'd believe you. I'd totally believe you. And we would be talking about a 200 or 300 year old legend of some mysterious big cat like we do other things, but we're not. We're talking about something that happened within the last 50 years, and yet the same thing happens. So don't doubt that 75 years from now, there's going to be two clowns like Adam and I talking about this mysterious big cat and, you know, that it came from hell or some kind of portal. Okay.
Right. Well, and see, they've created a problem for themselves, like... academics do a lot in cryptozoology. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, okay, we tell you there is a large wildcat here. You are unwilling to believe that. You call us crazy for seeing, you know, a black panther or whatever in this area. You say there's no historical evidence of large cats here. Nope, can't be. We show you the evidence, all this stuff. Okay. So then the other option is cryptid. Mm-hmm. This is a new species of something. It's magical. It's whatever. And then you go, nope, not that.
Yeah.
Well, what is it? Because it's something. Mm-hmm. So you've got to pick your poison that you're going to look into?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to take seriously the fact that there could be a large cat that has taken up residence here, several of them, in fact, in order to have a breeding population? So we have several large cats now living in the Exmoor National Forest. And look into that and potentially come across evidence that you then go, oh yeah, okay, we do. We've got wild cats here now. How they got here, we'll have to research, but we've got wild cats. Or are you going to keep denying that? And then people are going to put evidence or put time and effort into the magical, mythological thing. Mm-hmm. That you're going to poo-poo.
Mm-hmm.
You can't poo-poo at all.
Right.
There's evidence of something.
Yeah.
And you always talk about Occam's razor, mm-hmm. you know, you say, well, what's the more, it's gotta be misidentification. It's gotta be a natural species. It's gotta, you know, when you talk Bigfoot, they're like, oh no, you're misidentifying a natural species that lives there. It's probably a bear that was running on its hind legs for 3/4 of a mile, which it can't do, but that's what you say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we're now got a group of people that are saying, hey, this is a natural species. We know these animals exist. We know that they have historically not existed on the island here. We get that, but we got them now. And here's the evidence. You got to take that seriously. Well, how are you going to poo-poo everything? You're just creating a vicious cycle of now it's a mythical legend
mm-hmm.
that is going to get blown out of proportion, and you have lost all credibility because you wouldn't take the natural thing seriously. You're certainly not going to take the mythological thing seriously. So now they're not going to believe you if you tell them it's a natural species.
Yeah, exactly.
You've shot yourself in the foot. And I don't know. It then ends up, like Matt said, where we then talk about it because you get the Beast of Exmoor and people talk yeah. about, oh, it's this, it's a crazy, you know, demonic cat and da 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 da. It's the Ozark Howler of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, not really.
Right.
It's probably just an actual large wildcat, but nobody takes that seriously. So, you know, where do we go from here? But there are, not in this area, didn't see it in the Exmoor National Forest, probably because it's privately owned land and people can't do this. Yeah. But in other areas like the Peak District, there are trail cam footage of a large wildcat. It's actually, you know, being proven now. And I would say this all ties together. The UK, Britain is not a large landmass.
Right.
Especially compared to the US. You know, it's not a couple hours and you can be one side to the other. Large cats have a wide hunting range. So they could potentially be in both areas.
Sure. Yeah.
And if you got it in one, guarantee you they migrate to the other mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So it's, to me, the guy who is a cryptid fanatic here, I'm like, yeah, that is probably a wildcat. And it's in the cryptid realm only because the scientist won't take it seriously.
Right.
And so they push it to the cryptozoology realm.
Yeah. And the, I can understand that they're looking at this going, well, if it was there was a breeding population, we'd see them. We wouldn't have to hunt for them so much. You know, they would be obvious. I mean, we can go out and you don't have to try very hard. If you go to the right places, you will see mountain lions and pumas and tigers, cougars and lynxes and bobcats and all that. You will see them. You can find them. But my argument would be that, all right, 50 years with a cat that has a 12 to 15 year lifespan, that's not long enough. It's not long enough for there to be a huge population of these things just everywhere where you can now just go and come across them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things aren't like, you know, rabbits or deer or anything that, that breed just constantly. I mean, big cats don't breed like that. You know, it's not like feral cats, you know, it's like, this is different. So my argument would be, and of course my argument comes from absolutely no scientific background at all, is that there just hasn't been enough time, you know. Give it another 100 years and somebody's going to be go, oh, you know, big cats used to not be native to this area of the UK, but they are now.
Right. I'm with you there. And it'll be like they're native to this area because in the 80s, enough people let them go and then they set up shop. And, you know, scientists denied it until it got to a point where they couldn't deny it anymore.
Exactly.
And what's going to happen in my non-scientific estimation here is that they're going to deny it and deny it and deny it for so long. Then it becomes a problem because of the smallness of the island that they're on. And then the native prey species start getting wiped out when they could have put some effort into it now, early enough on, and maybe headed that off. You know, captured these wild cats, put them in zoos, and then they would still be living, but they wouldn't then just populate the UK.
Yeah, exactly. But this was, I liked this research, and I think this show is important. I don't believe this is a cryptid at all, but it definitely shows you how these cryptid stories begin. I mean, it just lays it out there. This is how they begin. This is where it all starts. You know, something that is absolutely real is somewhere that it's not supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories begin and some authoritative entity says, no, 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 that cannot be. Next thing you know, we got the Beast of Exmoor.
Mm-hmm.
So, tell us what you think about this. I mean, you know, maybe you do think this is some kind of, you know, crazy cryptid cat that's hanging around, and that's why there's not more of them that we see. If we've got listeners, and I know we've got listeners in the UK, they let us know, they write to us. Tell us, have you heard this story? Do you know the story? What does it feel like there? You know, is this something that people just laugh about and go, can you believe the government is still denying the existence of these things? And you know full well that they're there. Let us know. And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. Thousands of people sharing these kind of experiences, talking about things we've discussed on the show, jokes, memes, you name it. It's in there. It's a lot of fun. No one's going to make fun of you. Just get in there and kind of share your thoughts and your stories. Don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. You can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show and you can become a patron. Thank you to everyone who has donated to the show. A huge back catalog. Now is a great time to get in there, get some of that extra fun out of the ordinary Graveyard Tales content for that next big road trip. Hey, you know, mm-hmm. we'll do our best to keep you entertained the whole time. So
exactly.
All right. Until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.